From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Mike Huckabee is the only presidential candidate who identifies himself as an evangelical, but his candidacy is driving a wedge between the old guard evangelical leadership and young evangelicals, according to New York Times Washington correspondent David Kirkpatrick. He'll explain that division on today's Fresh Air. Also, the unintended consequences of the immigration crackdown. We hear from Julia Preston, national immigration correspondent for the New York Times. She says the effort to reduce illegal immigration has actually had the effect of increasing the number of illegal immigrants who stay in the United States. And book critic Marian Corrigan reviews the novel People of the Book by Geraldine Brooks. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Mike Huckabee is the only candidate in the presidential race who identifies himself as an evangelical. But according to New York Times reporter David Kirkpatrick, instead of uniting conservative Christians, Huckabee's candidacy is threatening to drive a wedge into the movement, potentially dividing its best-known national leaders from part of their base and upending assumptions that have held the right wing together for the past 30 years. Kirkpatrick is a Washington correspondent for The Times. He traveled with the Huckabee campaign in Iowa and New Hampshire. During the 2004 presidential campaign, he covered the Christian conservative movement. Kirkpatrick's article, headlined "Young Evangelicals Embrace Huckabee as Old Guard Box," was on the front page of Sunday's New York Times. I asked Kirkpatrick to describe the way in which Huckabee is dividing the Christian conservative movement.
It's been interesting for a couple years now, as we've moved closer and closer to the 2008 election, that the best known, the most prominent leaders of the Christian conservative movement in politics in Washington have really kept their different distance from Governor Huckabee. Governor Huckabee, as you know, is a Southern Baptist minister himself and has known these people for a good long time. And so it has been more and more puzzling to see that they have been somewhat reticent in their embrace of the Huckabee campaign. And several of the people who we've associated with the movement over the last few years have actively embraced one of the other candidates, Pat Robertson backing Giuliani, Gary Bauer, a former Christian conservative candidate backing Fred Thompson, and so on. It's threatening to drive a wedge into the movement because Governor Huckabee has very self-consciously decided that he would take his message straight to the pews. He hasn't really bothered to court the people who we think of as the leaders of the Christian conservative movement. He's tried to go directly to their followers, bypassing them, and he's done it with a message which is notably different from the direction that the Christian conservative movement has gone since Reagan.
How is his direction different?
Well, it's different in that since the 70s, since the kind of birth of the Reagan coalition, a lot of people have seen evangelical Christians and the Christian conservative movement as sort of thoroughly conservative, meaning limited government, low taxes, an aggressive foreign policy, a very muscular stance towards other countries, and also opposition to abortion, same-sex marriage, and so on. And what Governor Huckabee has done is he's taken those last two, opposition to abortion and same-sex marriage, and as well as a sort of outspoken advocacy for expression of religion in public life, and he's married that to a more populist economic appeal, and his record in Arkansas that shows a willingness to occasionally, now and again, raise taxes in order to do things that would help out working people. And what we're seeing is that that strikes a chord at the base of the Christian conservative movement, but not so much at the top.
You were on the road with Huckabee in Iowa and New Hampshire. How much did he stress in his speeches the two big issues for evangelicals in the 2004 campaign, and that was, you know, banning abortion and gay marriage?
Well, it came up a lot, but it comes up in a delicate way. From the moment that he announced his candidacy, he has been very clear that he believes support for life, that is the pro-life movement, should extend beyond birth, from conception all the way to the grave. And he never fails to incorporate a broader argument about human equality in his argument about protecting a fetus. And that has, to a certain extent, distinguished him from a lot of other Christian conservatives, and sometimes even got on their nerves, because he'll say things like, "I don't think pro-life should mean just the gestation period." And if you're in the conventional pro-life movement, where the focus has really been the gestation period, that might feel like a little bit of a jab to you.
A lot of the older evangelical leaders are leaving the stage. They've died or they're going to be retiring soon. You want to run through some of those older leaders who have already gone or are on the way out?
That's right. Huckabee has sort of arrived at a moment when the evangelical world is already in the midst of a kind of generational turnover. The leaders who first brought evangelicals, conservative Christians, into politics in the 1970s and pretty much led the movement since then are by and large dying or passing or moving on towards retirement. Jerry Falwell is the most prominent one. Reverend Robertson is getting quite on. Dr. James Dobson is laying the groundwork for succession at his organization, Focus on the Family. The folks who took over the Southern Baptist Convention, which is really a kind of mainstay of the conservative Christian movement, and turned it so decisively to the right during the 1980s, they're dying, moving on. Dr. G.D. James Kennedy, another big televangelist and leader of the movement, just passed away. So it goes on and on. And in their place, a new generation of pastors and spokesmen are coming forward, and they're all pro-life. None of them are crazy about the idea of same-sex marriage, but they're increasingly thinking that those issues ought to take their place alongside a broader array of issues.
What's the broader array of issues?
Well, the one that one's gotten a lot of attention is concern for the environment. But you also hear talk about racial reconciliation, about help for the poor, about humanitarian causes abroad, a whole package of things. And those older issues, you know, abortion, same-sex marriage, the core issues of personal morality that have motivated evangelical political involvement for the last 30 years, there's not a lot of gray there. You're either on one side or the other. But once you get into thinking, you know what, we've got a biblical mandate to start talking about helping the poor or advancing racial reconciliation, etc., then both left and right can make arguments. You know, there's certainly a conservative argument that low taxes and more tax cuts are going to help the poor, but there's also a liberal argument that a more effective way to help the poor from time to time is government action. So it gets to be a little bit more of a contested terrain, and you begin to see ways that people on the left might begin to speak to those constituencies in religious terms with a little bit more authenticity.
Is Huckabee trying to get endorsements from the older leadership of the conservative evangelicals?
Yes, he is. He's really doing his best. And I think when I've spoken to him about this, he has seemed genuinely puzzled that they haven't rallied to his cause. Governor Huckabee has definitely tried in his own way to reach out to those folks. He met with a group called the Arlington Group, an organization that's kind of an alliance of Christian conservatives. He met with them for a while en masse. He's spoken at the conferences held by the Family Research Council, another big Christian conservative group. But he hasn't done nearly as much as his opponent, Mitt Romney. Governor Romney, who in a certain sense had his work cut out for him because he, in terms of his own faith, is a Mormon, a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and also a relative recent convert to the cause of opposing abortion. Governor Romney has worked very hard to court those leaders. He's sat down with all of them for hours. He's talked to them at length about his sort of change of heart on the subject of abortion rights and why he now so strongly opposes abortion, he says, about his fight against same-sex marriage in Massachusetts. He's really knocked himself out to win those folks over.
Are there Christian conservative leaders who are uncomfortable with Romney because they're uncomfortable with his faith? He's Mormon.
Well, that's a tricky question. Publicly, I think most people at the leadership level would say, look, the important thing is where a candidate stands on our issues, and we shouldn't get too caught up in their personal religion. You know, we don't want to be religious bigots here. Certainly at the grassroots, the fact that he's a Mormon takes a toll on his support, and that's one of the sort of unquantifiable elements in this race. It's impossible to know how much of Governor Huckabee's success in Iowa reflects grassroots evangelicals flocking to him because he was an evangelical running against a Mormon. So there it is. And I would guess that, based on some of the conversations I've had, that at the leadership level of the movement, there are some concerns as well. The way it gets articulated when you talk to regular old churchgoers is like this. People say, you know, he's changed his positions on a number of issues, including abortion, which makes me wonder, what's the foundation of his views? So I look further, and I see that it's not the foundation of my views, it's a different foundation, it's a different faith, and that makes me trust him even less.
Tell us about the group Huck's Army and where they fit into the conservative Christian movement.
Huck's Army is an online organization set up by two brothers, Alex and Brett Harris, who live in Portland, Oregon, and they're kind of evangelical prodigies. They're 19-year-old twins who grew up in a family really steeped in the movement, and they've been writing for a Focus on the Family website. That's a very prominent Christian conservative group, and they've just got a book out now about sort of biblical lessons about teenagers, and they run their own website for Christian teens. And a few months ago, I think they saw Governor Huckabee appearing on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, and they really liked what he had to say, and they liked what he had to say because it's not your father's conservatism, so to speak. They liked the idea that the pro-life concerns should extend beyond gestation and all the way to the grave and include a kind of heart for poor people or people suffering in other countries. And so they've set up this website that connects different Huckabee, pro-Huckabee meetup groups around the country and solicits new volunteers. They say they now have 10,000 participants in different Huckabee meetup groups, and they've arranged for state directors in 45 states with regional directors below them to try to turn out a grassroots force to help the Huckabee campaign, because Governor Huckabee and his campaign have very little money and almost no national organization. And I think they were caught a little bit by surprise by their own last-minute success in the Iowa caucus, and they're sort of flat-footed. Even that success came almost unbidden because they had very little grassroots organization on their own, and they depended largely on pastors and informal networks of homeschoolers and other churchgoers to help get out the vote. And so this Huck's Army is an attempt to do that, but it's also a kind of example of the generational differences that we see in the evangelical world, where these two 19-year-olds with their website have reached out to all these other, by and large, young evangelicals and to a certain extent pro-life Catholics around the country at the same time as their elders have been notably reticent about supporting Governor Huckabee and his campaign.
My guest is David Kirkpatrick, a correspondent for the New York Times Washington Bureau. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. David Kirkpatrick is my guest, and he covered the Christian conservative movement for the New York Times during the 2004 election. Now he's a correspondent in the Washington Bureau of the Times, and he's been on the road reporting on the Huckabee campaign. And he describes the Huckabee candidacy as threatening to drive a wedge between the Christian conservative movement's leaders and its grassroots. Can I read you something that Howard Fineman wrote in the January 14th edition of Newsweek and get your reaction to it? This is about Huckabee. He wrote, "Republicans and their secular conservative allies are distraught at the thought of Huckabee as the GOP's 2008 presidential nominee. They couch their fears in terms of secular issues, his spending record as governor, his advocacy of a national sales tax, his confusion about the location of Pakistan. Privately, however, what worries the insiders is that blue and purple America will run shrieking from a fellow who doesn't believe in the science of evolution, but who does believe that the Bible is pretty close to literally true." Does that assessment ring true with what you've been hearing?
No, it doesn't ring true with what I've been hearing, for two reasons. The first is that what I hear from conservatives, secular and religious, really is that they are unnerved by his economic record, by his populist rhetoric, by his kind of wailing against Wall Street and the Washington establishment, and by his frankly conciliatory talk towards other countries, which feels kind of soft to them. And I think those are genuine concerns of principle. The other reason is that Governor Huckabee has been extremely adroit in handling questions about his support for creationism and other Christian conservative issues in public. I think the moment in one of the early Republican primary debates when he was questioned about his stated support for creationism was frankly the best moment that creationism has had since the Scopes trial. He has a knack for turning those questions around so that in that case he basically said, look, the reason I'm for creationism is because to me evolution means we're living in a godless world. We're living in a world where there is no reason for anything to be, and everything happens only through chaos, and there's no moral law. I don't believe that. I believe there was a first cause. And when you press him further, he'll say, look, you know, was the world created in 6 days? I don't know. Ask God. All I'm saying is I believe that there is a creator, and the definition of a creator is that he created everything. And that he has a way of publicly articulating these views, which is distinctly not scary to someone who had not grown up in the Christian conservative tradition.
You covered the Christian conservative movement in 2004 during the presidential campaign, and I'm wondering what you heard Christian conservatives say about Bush in 2004 compares to what you're hearing them say about him now.
Well, in 2004, there really was an extraordinary bond between President Bush and conservative Christian churchgoers across the country. You know, he really seemed to be a person of very authentic and heartfelt faith who was speaking their language and who was hearing their prayers. And people rallied around him in an extraordinary way. In retrospect, it looks like there was a tremendous kind of unanimity and cohesion in the conservative Christian world because he was able to bring that out. He was able to forge that bond with them. And so for a little while, some of the differences at the grassroots level appeared to be, to sort of fade away. You didn't notice them as much. Now, when you talk to people, you still hear a kind of identification with President Bush, but it's not so much admiration anymore. Now it's almost sympathy. You know, you hear people say, and I'm generalizing here, but in general, you hear people say, you know, he's a good man. He's got a good heart. I think his faith is sincere, but he's over his head. Or, but he had some bad advice. Or, but he made some mistakes, and now he just doesn't know how to admit that he's wrong. And so it's a kind of agonizing feeling for those Christian conservatives who supported him so ardently in 2004. And Governor Huckabee has sort of, in a way, breathed a new life into the grassroots. He's kind of galvanized them here and there in spots around a new name and a new cause.
Mike Huckabee is a man who knows his way around a microphone. He did his first broadcast at, I think, the age of 11 and delivered his first sermon at around 15. He pastored a church at 18. What's he like on the stump?
He's, by all accounts, a very gifted speaker. His critics and his supporters all agree that in the Republican field this year, he is the communicator. He brings an unusual style for any candidate to the stump, but it's an especially unusual style for somebody who comes out of the conservative Christian tradition that he does. It's on the one hand, it's almost sort of campy. He occasionally gets into really what is kind of a Christian stand-up comedy act. He jokes, you know, when I was with him in Iowa in the days before the caucus, he launched into a long riff about really voter suppression, you know, and it's all joke, joke, joke. But he would say, look, you know, if you know your neighbors are going to come out and vote for me, go out there and shovel the driveways. And be sure to shovel the snow into your other neighbors who aren't going to go out for me. You know, that kind of thing. And he gets a huge laugh with that. You know, or he'll say, you know, people ask me, do I believe in the resurrection? Of course I do. In Arkansas, dead people vote every election. And he'll go into a story about people going out into the graveyards to dig up names and take them to the polls. And the other thing that he does that distinguishes him certainly from most of the candidates this year and also from most prominent Christian conservatives is he is an avowed rock and roll fan. He likes nothing more than a chance to bring out his bass guitar and jam with a local band on the stump. In fact, you know, he hasn't really had much money to pay staff or build an organization or send people out to turn out a crowd. So he mostly, when he was traveling around New Hampshire or Iowa, would rely on these rock and roll gigs that he would put together and appearances with Chuck Norris, another conservative Christian who decided to endorse him, to try to draw out a crowd. At a lot of Huckabee rallies, they're punctuated by cries of Chuck, 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 Chuck. And you really wonder, you know, how many people are here to see Governor Huckabee and how many people are here to see Chuck Norris?
You've described Huckabee as having a populist streak, but what do you mean when you use the word populist?
Well, as one prominent Christian conservative put it to me, there's a kind of a melody and a harmony to Governor Huckabee's pitch. And the melody is, I'm pro-life, I'm an evangelical Christian. And the harmony is, I'm one of you. I grew up a working person. I can empathize with the concerns of working people. You should elect someone who reminds you of your coworker, not the guy who laid you off. And along with that goes a kind of a effort to rally people against the Washington establishment or Wall Street or some elite of the party, and to stress his empathy with people who are having a hard time economically. So rhetorically, he is a thoroughgoing populist and from time to time sounds not that different from John Edwards on the Democratic side of the party. Now, in terms of policy, it's a little bit more complicated. When he was in Arkansas, he showed a willingness to occasionally raise taxes to try to provide social services to working people or poor people or better education or better roads that makes some people in the Republican Party uncomfortable. On the other hand, he also has signed a pledge that he won't raise taxes. And the centerpiece of his domestic agenda is something called the fair tax, which is kind of a off-the-shelf, if you will, a tax idea that's been kicking around for a decade or so that has kind of a cult following. And it would basically replace all of our payroll and income taxes with a flat sales tax combined with rebates. And it's very hard to find economists who think that this is a workable idea or a good idea or at all progressive. But he presents it out on the stump in terms that sound almost Jeffersonian. He says, you know, we're going to tax consumption. We're going to take the burden off of producers. And people really go for it because in those kinds of gauzy terms, it sounds, you know, very uplifting to the common man.
David Kirkpatrick, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
David Kirkpatrick is a correspondent in the Washington Bureau of the New York Times. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Lionsgate, releasing the Western thriller 310 to Yuma on DVD and Blu-ray disc January 8th. From VH1, presenting the Critics' Choice Awards live tonight at 9, 8 Central. Award season begins tonight on VH1. And from Barnes & Noble, presenting daily book reviews, author interviews, and more in the Barnes & Noble Review, online at bn.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the dilemmas, paradoxes, and failures of the immigration crackdown. We talk with journalist Julia Preston, national immigration correspondent for the New York Times. And Maureen Corrigan reviews People of the Book by Geraldine Brooks, which Maureen describes as a Jewish twist on books like The Da Vinci Code and The Name of the Rose. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Immigration policy has become a key issue in the presidential campaign, particularly among Republican candidates. An effort to overhaul federal immigration law in Congress collapsed last summer, and many states and local governments are enacting their own immigration statutes. Meanwhile, there are huge backlogs in processing applications for citizenship among legal immigrants. For some perspective on the issue, we turn to Julia Preston, the national immigration correspondent for the New York Times. Before covering immigration in the United States, Preston spent several years reporting from Mexico. She spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies.
Well, Julia Preston, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, of course, there was a huge effort in Congress to pass a comprehensive immigration bill, which failed earlier this year. But apart from that effort, to what extent has the executive branch of the government undertaken steps to deport more immigrants, exercise greater control over them, their lives?
Well, this is something that I think is not well understood. The beginning of what we could call a crackdown, particularly at the southern border with Mexico, didn't begin with the Bush administration. It didn't begin just in the last few years, but it really began with the Clinton administration. And part of what we're seeing now, this intense concern about immigration and specifically illegal immigration, is a consequence of some of the unintended effects of that early enforcement. In other words, we have been tightening our border really since the mid-1990s. And one of the effects of that has been that, especially from Mexico, what used to be a kind of a circular migration of people coming and going, farm workers, seasonal labor in factories, that kind of thing, is no longer seasonal and cyclical. People can get in, or they did succeed in getting in, but now they are not going home because the costs of and risks of returning have become very high.
Give us an example of that, of how a family might have used the border before that crackdown, and what happens now?
Well, the traditional sources of migration from Mexico are states like Michoacán and Guanajuato, Jalisco. These are states that have been sending farm workers to the United States on a seasonal basis for generations. And the pattern was that those workers would come for the agricultural season, leave their families in Mexico, and make, by their standards, a lot of money, and then take it home and create their lives in Mexico. But the increasing enforcement of the border has meant that that's not an option, that process of leaving your family in Mexico and going home regularly. The people used to go home to Mexico two or three times a year. So now they feel that they have to remain in the United States, partly also because there was a job boom, for example, in California, so that farm workers could find work in construction and other industries during the winter. And so they started to bring their families here. And then you have kids that are born in the United States to immigrant families and with illegal immigrant parents. And then they're in school and there's settlement. A surprising number of immigrants, for example, in the Chicago area have purchased houses, even though they don't have Social Security numbers. So there's been a whole settlement that has been an uncalculated impact of the enforcement of the border.
So if I understand you, what you're saying is that in the past, people would slip back and forth illegally, I assume, but relatively easily. But now it's a riskier crossing, so they make one great leap with their families and settle here.
Yes, that has been increasingly the pattern. Of course, what has happened in the last year, and especially since the failure of what was called comprehensive reform in the Senate, there has been a much escalated effort to crack down on illegal immigration. And this past year, there was a record number of arrests of illegal immigrants, I think more than 38,000 illegal immigrants in various categories were arrested. And the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, which is the law enforcement arm of our immigration policy, has become the second largest federal law enforcement agency. They've been tremendously active creating teams to hunt down what they call fugitive aliens, that is, people who came across the border and were caught and let go and then came into the country anyway. It's just been an extremely active agency, and the effect of that has really been felt very strongly in immigrant communities.
It sounds as if what you're saying is the consequence of the effort to reduce illegal immigration by tightening the border actually had the paradoxical effect of increasing illegal immigration.
I wouldn't say that it increased illegal immigration. What I would say is that it was not dissuasive for many years, and it did discourage people from going home. So what it definitely encouraged was settlement of immigrants, both legal and illegal, in the United States. And so really all of the political tensions that we're seeing now, I think, arise not so much out of the conflict between American workers and immigrants and illegal immigrants in the workplace, although there is some of that. But really it has to do with the presence of so many people that are here without legal status in our communities. So what has really riled many Americans is when you're starting to get large numbers of Spanish-speaking children in the school system, and you have to deal with that. And you have community issues, the hospital, the emergency room. These are the flashpoints. This is a major law and order issue for many people. In a context where you have American working class people who are living in a period of great uncertainty in their lives, and people ask the question, which is, I think, a fair question, why should I, the taxpayer, be called upon to support people who are not in the country legally?
You know, you mentioned that people object to illegal immigrants and the drain they are on resources, but you also said that it's a law and order issue. Are illegal immigrants more prone to breaking the law, to committing violent crimes?
No, not at all. At least statistically, they're not. But when you think of it as a political issue, it becomes a more complex question because, for example, among the population of illegal immigrants who are in the United States are a large number of very dangerous gang members from the Mara Salvatrucha and some of these Central American and Mexican gangs that have extended their influence into the United States. And so this is a very small part of the population overall, but they are very prominent in the minds of some people who live in the communities where they're active. The problem is that the illegal status of these immigrants makes it a very difficult issue to sort out at a time when Americans are increasingly concerned about the rule of law. And the other problem with the issue in political terms and in moving towards a solution is that it's been very divisive between the states and the federal government. So you have great frustration at the state level because there's a resource problem. The federal government failed to enforce the border, hasn't passed any new immigration law, and yet the states are having to deal with the hospitals in many cases and the school systems that are facing new challenges because of the new immigration. And so it creates a tension and a distrust between the states and the federal government and people at the state level that is also becoming part of this very toxic political mix that we have now.
We're speaking with Julia Preston. She is the New York Times national immigration correspondent. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Julia Preston. She is a journalist for the New York Times covering the immigration issue. I wanted to talk a bit about some of the ways that this crackdown has affected foreign nationals living in the United States. I mean, one of the things that you have written is that relatively minor infractions can get foreign nationals in really big trouble. How? What do you mean?
Well, first of all, one of the things that's happened is that you have a population of almost 12 million people who are illegal immigrants who are very sensitive to the law enforcement environment and are basically retreating from community life all over the country. You've created in a very short period of time a kind of semi-fugitive population in cities all over the country. What do I mean by that? People who think twice every time they go out of the house, people who don't go to parties, who are reluctant to go to school meetings, who think twice about going to the police to report something that they saw in the neighborhood, people who avoid the police that really will go out of their way to take a different route to avoid any kind of contact with the police on the highway. And so this is one thing that it really is causing a really dramatic change, I think, in the quality of life and the feeling of engagement in our society in immigrant communities across the country. One of the ways that you see that, for example, was a Pew Hispanic Center survey that came out in December that 53% of the Hispanic people in the United States feel that they or a loved one could be deported or is facing the risk of deportation. And that raises the other thing that's happening, which is that because so much of this has to do with settlement and immigrant settlement in our communities, you don't get illegal immigrants who are kind of off in the corner. What you get is a mixed status family. So you have three or four children who were born in the United States. You have a father who is a legal immigrant, a mother who does not have legal papers. So the impact when you start to crack down on illegal immigrants really radiates out across the Hispanic community.
And it becomes more isolated.
Yes.
And do you think that's destructive for the communities that they inhabit?
Well, it's certainly a risk. I mean, what we're talking about is something that is acutely felt, but quite short term. It would be, I think, fanciful to say at this point that this is something that's affecting assimilation. But the issue going forward is this what we want to continue, or do we want to solve the problem in a different way by finding ways to reincorporate these people back into our social mainstream? And of course, that's the great issue that is under political debate at this point.
You know, you've written that one of the manifestations of this crackdown is that you will see an immigrant who gets stopped for a taillight being out on his pickup truck ends up in an interaction with a police officer and admitting to being an illegal immigrant, which years ago might have gone unprosecuted, now gets him thrown in the jail and then put in the hands of immigration authorities. And so you have thousands of people now being in this process for potential deportation. Can the Immigration and Customs Enforcement folks handle all these people?
Well, before I address that, I just want to say I remember that man who was deported because he had a taillight who was out. That was, I met him in a jail in Colorado. And it was a remarkable experience because he was not at all bitter. He said, in jail, about to be deported because of this completely minor traffic violation, he said, I'm just very grateful to the United States that I had an opportunity to be here for 8 years. I put my kids through primary school. I made more money than I could ever make in my country. It was just a very memorable experience about the complexities of this and really the extraordinary people who have been caught up in it. Certainly one of the characteristics that is irrefutably true about the vast majority of people who are illegal immigrants living in this country is that they would much prefer to be legal. If there had been a legal channel, I'm sure they would have taken it. In addition to that, the many millions of people who are struggling their way through the legal immigration system are subject to interminable waits, multiple disappointments, their papers get lost. I mean, even the most routine case is sometimes very difficult. So Citizenship and Immigration Services is an agency that is trying to do its job. But, for example, they don't get any money as a matter of policy from the federal government. It's a fee-based agency. And so suddenly in the last year, for example, you had this enormous surge of legal immigrants who wanted to become American citizens. This is what we want as a nation.
And that surge is driven by the crackdown? Or?
Yes, in part. It's partly a demographic issue because there were many Mexicans who became eligible. They've been legal permanent residents for a period of time. And also there was a major fee increase that went into effect in the middle of this year, and that had something to do with it, too. It was the combination of this very uncertain environment created by the political debate with the knowledge that suddenly it was going to become more expensive. And because they feel insecure in their status, even as legal immigrants, once you become a citizen, nobody can take that away from you. We're over a million people this year who have applied to become citizens.
Is the federal government going to do anything to relieve that backlog?
Well, they are going to have to. Currently, the surge is so great that the prospect is that all these people who have rushed to come forward, many of whom did so because they are very keen to vote in November, won't be able to because of bureaucratic hang up that will prevent them from getting their citizenship in time to register to vote. So this is really counterproductive. We say that we want assimilation and we want people to accept our values and join our society, and yet we make it a complete bureaucratic nightmare for them to do so.
I wanted to ask you about one interesting development that has occurred a lot during this crackdown. Children who are born in the United States are considered citizens, even if they are born to parents who are illegal immigrants. And there have been a number of cases where sweeps capture people who are illegal immigrants, but their kids are citizens and entitled to stay in the States. What sort of dilemmas does that present?
Well, very troubling ones, I think. You have with these increasing thousands of illegal immigrants being deported, most often these are people who have families. And we like to think that they were people who came recently, but what you find is that these are illegal immigrants who have been living in this country and working in this country for a decade or more, 8, 9 years, and they have one or two children who were born in the United States. And so now we're in a situation where we are in effect deporting substantial numbers of United States citizens overseas. I think we haven't even begun to think about the implications of that. They will not lose their citizenship, and so it's very likely that they may come back one day to live in this country. Who knows what that experience might do of having been rejected by your own country when you were a small child. But
the kids are legally entitled to stay if someone asserts that right on their behalf, right?
They're legally entitled to stay, but the parents don't want to be separated from their children, although it is a very wrenching decision because in many cases the parents come thinking that their goal is to work and make money and send that money home. But when the children are born in this country, then they get into school and the parents see that the children have educational opportunities here that they would never have in their home countries. And that becomes an additional driving force and motive for many illegal immigrant parents. And so leaving that behind is also very heartbreaking.
I know that you spent a long time in Mexico covering political events there, and I'm just wondering how that experience informs your understanding of the immigration issue. I mean, I know this is a broad question, but is there some fundamental insight that you get from seeing the issue south of the border?
Well, just that people from Mexico have made our two countries into a region. We have what has been essentially a unified labor market involving people, especially from northern Mexico. And yet, even though the possibilities for understanding and integration and cooperation have never been greater between our two countries, in the period of time since I came back from Mexico in 2001, things have just become more and more distant. And I think it's really unnecessary. For example, the border, we will never succeed in enforcing our border or getting the kind of control over the southern border that we want without the cooperation of Mexico. And Mexico has expressed rare willingness in the past few years to really step up and play its part to enforce that border. They won't do it unless they get better recognition from Washington for the effort, unless it's part of some kind of a very substantial bilateral discussion. And instead, what's happened is that in the course of the debate, you know, Mexico as a country has just been denigrated and belittled, and it's really very distressing.
Well, Julia Preston, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Julia Preston is the New York Times national immigration correspondent. She spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies. He's senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews Geraldine Brooks' new novel about a conservationist, a book conservationist, working on a rediscovered 15th century edition of an ancient Hebrew text. This is Fresh Air. Writer Geraldine Brooks has distinguished herself in the field of historical fiction through novels such as Year of Wonders, about the plague in medieval England, and the Pulitzer Prize-winning March, which takes place during the American Civil War. In her latest novel, People of the Book, Brooks moves into the realm of historical suspense. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
You may feel as though you've heard this review before. I certainly feel as though I've written it before. In actuality, for the blockbuster novels The Historian and The Rule of Four, and in my head for the most recent movie I've seen, National Treasure 2. You know the general story. An old manuscript turns up, containing clues to past tragedies and cover-ups. Once these encoded secrets are cracked, they transform the lives of the contemporary characters doing the detecting. We've traveled down this particular plot line a lot lately, especially if you include literary progenitors like the Da Vinci Code and The Name of the Rose. And now here we go again, with a Jewish twist on a bibliographic plot that's been mostly mined by classicists and Christian paranoics. Geraldine Brooks' latest novel, People of the Book, begins when a young book conservationist named Hannah Heath, who's based in Australia, gets an urgent phone call in the dead of the night, imploring her to come to Sarajevo to work on a newly rediscovered 15th-century illuminated Haggadah, a Hebrew text used during the Passover service. The Haggadah, it turns out, was rescued from certain destruction during the shelling of Sarajevo by a Muslim museum director who risked death to retrieve it. How curious that at this moment in time when so many culture critics are so pessimistic about the future of books and reading, we have this obsessive plot popping up again and again in popular fiction and film, centering on books as crucial, irreplaceable artifacts. That's especially true of Brooks's story, which centers not so much on the text of the Haggadah, but on its very bookness, its physicality. Wielding her conservator's delicate tools, Hannah extracts detritus from the binding and pages of the Haggadah, part of an insect's wing, salt crystals, and a single white hair. She analyzes the pigments in the illustrations which are themselves puzzling, since ancient Jewish law forbade the making of graven images or likenesses. And most ominously, she discovers blood mixed in with a centuries-old wine stain. Intermingled with Hannah's tale, which includes forays into her love life and her mysteriously nasty relationship with her mother, are chapters that hopscotch backwards to the very creation of the book. Bosnia during World War II, turn-of-the-century Vienna, Venice during the Inquisition, Spain in 1492 when the Jews were expelled. As that heroic Muslim museum director says to Hannah, "This book has survived the same human disaster over and over again. Think about it. You've got a society where people tolerate difference and everything's humming along, creative, prosperous. Then somehow this fear, this hate, this need to demonize the other, it just sort of rears up and smashes the whole society. Inquisition, Nazis, extremist Serb nationalists, same old, same old." True enough. And yet that quote conveys the overall formulaic and manipulative feel of people of the book. The characters and their individual storylines here are fairly one-dimensional, all designed to dramatize the human tragedy of intolerance and the resilience of the ideal of diversity. The bad characters, including Hannah's mother, can't accept difference. The good characters, including the anthropomorphic Haggadah itself, embrace the mixing of religions, races, and sexual preferences. Not a bad message, certainly, but one that never ventures beyond received pieties. People of the Book rattles along pleasantly enough. There are plenty of plot twists and digressions into arcane trades and cultural customs. This is the kind of novel in which you learn a lot about medieval methods of vellum production and water torture techniques during the Inquisition. But for a novel whose plot implicitly attests to the enduring power of books, People of the Book offers a reading experience that's ultimately as flat as a Passover matzah cracker.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed People of the Book by Geraldine Brooks. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Joan Tui Westman, Sam Brigger, Patty Leswing, Jonathan Menhivar, and John Sheehan. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, presenting daily book reviews, author interviews, and more in the Barnes & Noble Review, online at bn.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
When the Beatles first performed in Hamburg, Germany in 1960, they were befriended by Astrid Kircher, a young photographer who took now classic pictures of the band, gave them their famous haircuts, and got engaged to Stu Sutcliffe, who was then the band's bass player. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Kircher. Join us for the next Fresh Air.